Book session number 3183, reel 3.
Theodore McAvoy, Reel 3. You were telling me about flying at Henley.
Flying at Henley, yes. There were opportunities for it, but they weren't always made the use of that could have been made of. One of the reasons was that it was extremely expensive to insure yourself against flying risks, and one had to insure oneself and pay for it. And I remember one chap, and he was a senior officer on the course, who had an insurance policy which limited him to 10 hours flying a year. If he did over 10 hours flying a year, he had to pay a lot more. So he very quickly got his 10 hours in and then sat on the ground after that. But that left the aircraft to the rest of us, and we took full advantage of it. We were allowed to go off and visit places like Lucas in Scotland to get in flying time, and one used to crowd into all the Avros and Bristols and fly off to Scotland for the weekend and that sort of thing. It was great fun. And we also had a flight aerobatics team, and we used to take each other up and see if we could frighten each other by doing inverted spins in Lynx Avros and that sort of thing. We had a lot of fun.
Did you manage to frighten people?
Oh, we frightened each other, yes, very much.
But no accidents?
No, never. I don't remember a single accident at Henley. We were very responsible chaps, of course.
Tell me about this insuring yourself. Did you have to do that right from the very beginning?
Yes, if one wanted to insure oneself. One had a life insurance. I remember one of the officers on the engineering at the depot at Henlow was an agent for an insurance company. And he was the make a bit on the side by getting us to insure ourselves. And I actually took out a life policy, which was a ridiculously bad one. I'd never have taken it out with proper advice. But flying was off it. If one got done in flying, there was no payment. But you could include flying by payment of some exorbitant fee.
This wasn't something that the RAF then organised for you?
Oh, no, indeed. No, entirely an individual concern. And I didn't get flying pay in those days. Still, one didn't want it. It was such fun flying that was all a secondary consideration.
And how did people feel when this 10% cut came in on top of the already meagre pay?
Oh, cursing like hell, of course, but realising that the country was in a bit of a state and that one had to make a sacrifice.
Now, what happened when you finished the Henley course? Where were you posted then?
I was posted then to an engineering job at the Iraq Aircraft Depot at Hinnady, near Baghdad in Iraq. And
what did that base consist of at Hinnady?
The base consisted of an aircraft depot and a number of squadrons. There were 55 squadrons on Wapitis and 70 squadrons on Victorias and a command communications flight, and an armoured car company, and a number of other small auxiliary units. About 15 messes on the cantonment altogether. And I was in the aircraft depot, and I was in a squadron, B squadron, which was responsible for the erection and testing of Wapitis and DH-9As. So it was rather a pleasant job, because one looked after their assembly and erection and then tested them.
Did you have any problems with them, or were they a fairly reasonable plane to deal with?
Oh, very reasonable. I was also a command parachute officer and used to test parachutes by dropping them with 200-pound dummies, and we did a couple of jumps ourselves.
Presumably, had you training in parachuting in your fighter squadron?
Yes. We did the standard lift-off, of course, in the fighter squadrons from a Vini, which was very funny. Lot of humour attached to that. You've probably heard all the stories about people not letting go when they were told to. I remember George Beamish, who was a great, enormous Irish rugger international, an immense strength, didn't let go when he opened his parachute and pulled the Venu round into a turn. Eventually let go and came down. But we all enjoyed them.
What was the work? What did the workforce at Hinnady consist of that you had under you?
Well, there were a sergeant major and a couple of sergeants and a lot of airmen, and they were all expert craftsmen. And I remember the sergeant used to do the inspection, and a very meticulous inspection. Nothing ever got past him. But the airmen were so good in those days, so well trained, all Halton or Cranwell trained airmen, highly efficient. I really think the efficiency was simply tremendous in those days. One, nothing ever got over, or very seldom got overlooked.
Did you have any local labour?
We had, yes, there were craftsmen, local carpenters and people of that sort, Iraqis, who were employed under BORs, under British other ranks, and who did very good work.
To what extent was the routine of service life different in Iraq for you?
Well, it was different timing because of the hot, in the hot weather. One used to get up before dawn and do a stint before breakfast and then another stint after breakfast and then tiffin and then bed in the hot weather until one got up and played games in the evening. In the winter, routine was very much like the British routine. The usual sort of thing, colour hoisting parade and then march off to work and then do one's work for the rest of the day.
How much actual flying did you manage to get in?
Oh, quite a lot. I was both the testing, which involved quite a lot, the aircraft testing and the parachute testing, and visiting for trade test boards at other units, Shibern, Mosul, and occasionally doing a long distance flight to from Hinnady to Cairo to Abu Swir and the canal, on the canal. And then I was attached as flight commander to 55 Squadron for a few months and got in quite a lot of flying with them.
Were there any problems about flying in the climate there?
No, not really. It was very hot, of course. But once one got up above the heat, it was delightful and it might have been anywhere in the world.
Was the sand a problem at all?
Sandstorms, yes. Well, dust storms, yes. We called it dust because it was funny stuff. It was very soft, fine stuff, not abrasive. It was clogging and formed a frightful mud when the wet got on it. But it did come in up into the air quite a lot, and one never was quite certain where it was going to come up into the air, particularly on a south wind. And the weather forecasting wasn't too bright. I remember the typical forecast was dust in places at times, which didn't help one very much to know where exactly it was going to be and when. And if one did get caught in dust, there was nothing you could do about it except fly on with decreasing power and hope that the ground was flat underneath you. But if you were clever, you saw it and turned away and landed before you got into it.
Did you have an opportunity to fly any planes other than Wapatis while you were there?
Yes, we had the Wildebeest for trial, and I did a lot of flying on the Wildebeest, and we fitted it with a long-range tank, and I did the first flight from Hinnady to Abu Swir non-stop, but actually it wasn't to Abu Swir because the engine seized over Sinai, and I came down with a seized engine in the Sinai dunes, just with enough space to get down, fortunately. But the prop had stopped and the engine had seemed solid because although we'd put an extra fuel tank, we'd forgotten to fit an extra oil tank, so it used all its oil and seized. But no ill effects. They brought out, we spent the night in the desert and we'd fortunately put up an aerial and managed to transmit our position. And next day, a troop of camels came out bearing oil, and we filled up the oil tank and dug away a few of the sand dunes, ran up the engine. It ran for an awful long time with the oil pressure at naught, and then just as I was going to switch off in despair, the oil pressure jumped up. And it kept up, and I ran the engine up, and it kept up. And so I lightened, took all, everything out of the aeroplane and left my crew behind, took off and got to Eberswiller. And there we ran it up, yes, we found no defect in running up. We didn't take it down, we found no effect. And so we filled up with everything next day, and I flew back, landed at Ruffbar, and filled up with oil again at Ruffbar, and then flew back to Hinnady. And when I got there, we took the engine to pieces and found that although the bearings had broken into tiny pieces, not a single fragment of the bearing had escaped from the holder. So it spoke volumes for the Pegasus engine, and that it could run without oil like that and not burn up its bearings.
Was it a good plane to fly?
Oh, lovely. Yes, I like the Wildebeest. It's a lovely thing. Then we had the Demon out there, and we flew the Demon, which was a Hawker Hart variant, and we liked the Demon very much. But I was never able to fly the Victoria. That was 70 Squadron had a sort of pilots' union, and they never allowed anybody but a 70 Squadron pilot to fly a Victoria. So that was an aircraft I never flew except Joel.
Were there any problems about flying Victorias that meant this necessary?
Well, 70 Squadron said so, and they were enormous, great, heavy things, but judging by some of the fellows who did learn to fly them, it wasn't beyond human capacity.
For a short time, you commanded the communication flight at Hinnady. What did that involve?
That involved maintaining aircraft for staff officers to fly, who wished to fly, and for taking officers who couldn't fly or didn't wish to fly about on their proper duties. I can remember once, one of the aircraft we had there was the White Wapiti that the AOC flew, Air Marshal Sir Edgar Ludlow Hewitt, and he was a very stern, authoritarian, rather forbidding character. And we all respected him immensely. One time he had to fly up to Diana, which was a very small landing ground. Only expert pilots really could land there. It was only 360 yards long amongst the mountains, and you could only land one way, and all sorts of extraordinary wind currents were usually there. And he was flying up there on his White Wapiti, and I went up to escort him on another Wapiti. To my horror, on the way up, I saw that his aileron gap wires were floating out behind, which meant that they'd come undone, and he hadn't got any aileron control, and he was faced with a landing at Diana without aileron control. But when we arrived at Diana, I circled over him and watched. I saw this aeroplane coming in nearer and nearer to the ground, wondering how on earth he could do it, and he landed and came to a halt and taxied in. And I thought, well, this is my end. I shan't survive this, being responsible for providing an aircraft where the aileron gap was, but he didn't say a word about it. I think he may have said, see that my aeroplane's all right for the return journey or something of that sort, but not a word of censure, which quite amazed me, and we certainly made sure that it was all right next day.
He was unusually merciful on that occasion.
Oh, yes, he was very merciful indeed. I had the greatest respect for him. He's a man who really knew his job inside out, not only his own job, but he was a practicing pilot as well.
Did you come into contact very much with him while you were in the...
That was, I think, the only time I came into contact with him personally. But my great friend Wheeler was his ADC for a while, and so I used to hear a lot about him.
What sort of training was 55 Squadron doing when you joined it briefly in 1933?
Bombing was the great thing, of course. Bombing training, high-level bombing. That was one's role as a bomber squadron. And then, of course, we had to keep the landing ground. It was between wars. It was between two campaigns. So there wasn't actual fighting going on at the time. So our job was really to keep the landing grounds in good repair and see that they were properly marked out up in Kurdistan, places like Halebja and Pinjween, Rania and so on.
Did you do any night flying practice?
Yes, I just qualified as a night pilot while I was in 55 Squadron, just for the interest of doing it, which involved, I forget what it was, you had to do 5 or 6 night landings on a black night, I think, by the flare path, which were paraffin flares. But beyond that, there wasn't much in it.
There wasn't any long-range navigation by night that you had to do for the...
Not for this, no. No.
While you were with 55 Squadron, you were actually on the receiving end of a court-martial. How did that
happen?
Yes,
I was, yes. That was a very regrettable affair. One night, rather late at night, we were in the mess, and one of the chaps thought it might be a good idea to go out and shoot jackal. And it seemed to be a good idea too, and off we went shooting jackal. But unfortunately, a brother officer got in the way of the shot. And this should never have happened, of course. And the poor fellow was taken off to hospital to have the pellets taken out, a 410 shotgun. And the chap who shot him, we were both court-martialed, and the chap who shot him and I, and the chap who shot him got a severe reprimand and loss of seniority, and I got a reprimand for being the senior officer present at the time, which is a very regrettable interlude in one's career.
Was it a rather awe-inspiring experience to go in front of a court-martial board?
Well, there was such a sort of... the chap recovered, of course, and he regarded himself... a magnificent chap, who ever got shot, he regarded it as quite a joke. And everybody else except the prosecuting officer tended to regard it as a joke. And really, it was once the horror of having injured this fellow was over, it was really rather fun. But at first, of course, it was terrible thinking one would be responsible for injuring a fellow officer.
Did you put up any defence?
Oh, no, no, no. Naturally, one could only plead guilty to a thing like that.
In 1934, you returned to England and joined No. 1 Squadron at Tangmere.
Yes.
What changes did you notice after being aboard for 4 years?
Funnily, the only change, actual change I can remember, is that when doing one's map reading practices, one found all the secondary roads were now black. When one had left England, they'd been white. And now it was much more difficult because the secondary roads were all black. But that was the main difference. Otherwise, apart from having Furies instead of Siskins, the squadron life and things one did were very much the same as they had been.
What was your actual role, your job with No. 1 Squadron?
First of all, I was flight commander of A Flight. And then they needed, for some reason, I can't remember what, they needed an engineer officer in 43 Squadron. And so I went to command C Flight in 43 Squadron. And there we did the synchronized flight aerobatics for the RF display and a few other things. And then when the Abyssinian business started, Mussolini's exploits in Abyssinia in 1936, the CO of one squadron was sent off to Abyssinia or to Khartoum, and I took over command of one squadron as a flight lieutenant. And I commanded the squadron for a year, which was very jolly.
Tell me about what was the synchronised flight air.
Well, 25 Squadron had invented the flight roll, where the whole flight went round as a unit. And we had always been able to loop in as a flight, but this idea of rolling as a flight was a new thing invented by 25 Squadron. And 25 Squadron came over and showed us how it was done, and we were amazed. And within about half an hour, the whole of the air was filled with one squadron and 43 squadron flights all falling out of the air trying to do this barrel roll. And eventually, of course, everybody did button it up. And then to add a zest to it for the display, it was done with two flights with their aerobatics synchronized. And although we weren't, wasn't very spectacular, because we were not allowed to come below 2,000 feet. And we unfortunately observed that regulation, so it all looked a bit out of reach. But it was quite an enterprising affair.
In what ways did the Fury represent an advance on what you'd been used to, the Siskin and the 20?
It would fly faster and higher, but really, I don't think very much of an advance. It had exactly the same armament, the same almost useless. Two Vickers guns that have been in use since 1916. Absolutely no advance in armament at all from 1916 to 1937. It wasn't until we got the Hurricane and Spitfire that there was any advance.
Were there any disadvantages with the Fury?
No, except it had a water-cooled engine, which was rather a disadvantage. It was subject to internal water leaks, which caused trouble. I never had an engine failure, I must say. They were very reliable, but they did give a bit of maintenance trouble. And you had to remember your radiator shutter, which you didn't have on air-cooled engines.
Did you take part in the Royal Review at Mildenhall in 1935?
Yes, we did. I think every squadron in the Air Force took part in that. We all went up to Mildenhall, practiced several weeks beforehand, and then we arranged ourselves on the aerodrome for King George V and Prince Albert and the Prince of Wales to come around and see us. Duke of York, rather not. We called him the Duke of York later, didn't we? And then we flew past. He motored to Duxford, and then we all flew past him in wing formation from Mildenhall to Duxford.
In what ways was the kind of training that you were doing different from in the 1920s? Were any of the exercises any different that you were doing in the 1930s?
No, as far as I remember, everything was just about the same. The radio telephony worked better, but the other things, gunnery and map reading and so on, were all exactly the same, and the gunnery certainly hadn't advanced. As I told you, we had the same stupid old stuff. What was the other question you asked?
I was just wondering whether one thing we talked about last time was slight difference in the interception exercise.
Oh yes, well yes, that did change a little bit, but we were not told about it. 23 Squadron was doing these trials at the time with RDF without knowing what it was. RDF information was being fed to the controllers at Uxbridge, and 23 Squadron was allowed to practice on this, and they were achieving some very good results with interceptions. All happened with us, who weren't in the know. We were just told to obey the controllers when we were told to fly to us on a certain course, to obey them. In the past, we'd been told where to patrol and had to find our own way to it. But now we were told that to obey the controllers, they had ways of knowing where the enemy was, and to obey them. And towards the end of my time, that was just coming in, but we didn't know why. And it wasn't really effective with us. 23 Squadron, who were doing the trials, proved it was effective, and that was really the beginning of radar and radio-controlled interception.
Did you find that you still weren't intercepting, even with the advice of the control?
Yes, as far as I remember, we were still not intercepting, except by chance.
Did the expansion of the RAF that was beginning around about this time affect Number 1 Squadron?
I can remember we had to send off flights, break off flights to form new squadrons. I remember breaking off one flight to go off and form 72 Squadron on Gladiators. And so, of course, we rather deplored that because it took away some of our best pilots. But that was 36. I left at the end of 36.
And what were the replacements like who were coming in to your squadron?
Patchy. We had one or two very good ones, but others who were either badly trained or badly selected, probably as a result of the expansion.
What were their weaknesses?
Lack of, well, they were mixed, as I remember, were inability to fly in formation and inability to land where they were intending to land, which were all elementary sort of things, but although we tried very hard to get them to come in, fly close in formation, some of them were utterly reluctant to do so, and some of them just could not land properly. But I must say, they were only a few.
Is there still the same carefree atmosphere as regards drinking and flying, for instance, as there had been in the 1920s?
No, I would say not. No, I can't remember people ever having a drink at lunchtime at Tamere. Now, I think that had improved a lot.
Was it less enjoyable for that reason or not?
No, not at all. No, I enjoyed it all, every minute of it.
And did you enjoy your period leading the squadron?
Oh, very much. I had a grand bunch of chaps, including Teddy Donaldson, who's now the correspondent for the Telegraph, and he was a magnificent shot, best shot in the command. And so we did very well at Sutton Bridge with him.